The Tolkien Road, Episode 249, Akalabaith 2021. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 249. Greta, what's up?
Hey. Not a whole lot. We just had the 4th of July, mm-hmm. So that's always really fun.
Explosive.
Very explosive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was good timing. Explosive.
Explosive.
Explosive. Boom. But I was thinking, too, how the 4th of July is always a little bittersweet for me because, I mean, it's a wonderful holiday, and I love what it represents and what we celebrate. But it also makes me a little sad because, I mean, summer's like half over. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I can't believe that that's where we are. But
well, with as humid and muggy and everything as it's been where we live, I'm not too sad about summer being halfway over.
Yeah, so. I think it's not the weather I'm sad about.
Yeah.
It's mostly just the fact that, I feel like it's almost time to get ready for school to start again.
Yeah.
But hey, it's still summer and we still got a lot of good stuff coming up, so
and
it's all good.
And you're especially excited because you are going to be dropping some Akalabaith. You're going to be floating some Akalabaith knowledge balloons, as Marilyn the librarian would probably say. So instead of dropping knowledge bombs,
floating
knowledge balloons. Oh yeah,
balloons.
Yeah.
Oh,
remember that? That's what she in one of her letters she was like, "I prefer not the knowledge bombs, but floating the knowledge balloons."
Yeah, that's right. The peace-loving Marilyn.
Yes.
Yes, well, absolutely.
Absolutely. So on this episode, we are going to revisit Akalabaith, but this time around, Greta is going to lead our discussion in a little bit. We'll reintroduce why that is, right before we dive into that. But before we get started, we'd like to give a double up air five to our patrons. All right, you ready for this?
Let's do it.
Get ready, patrons. 3, 2, 1. Whoopsh. Yep. Boom.
I always hit my stand.
You got to be careful. Got to be careful about the old microphone stand.
Oh, no. Sorry, guys.
Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Lise Yu, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous. And a shout out to our newest patrons, Heathen Rohirrim and Wordy.
Yay,
so,
thanks,
you both.
Guys.
Thank you for becoming patrons.
Yeah.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. Also, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. If you are a 5-star fan of the Tolkien Road, you can really help us out by heading over to iTunes or your preferred source for the show and dropping us a rating and review. And I should say, it's not just heading over to iTunes, but in that podcast app, scrolling down to the bottom of our show and leaving a review right there. It's super easy to hit that 5 stars. And, say a few kind words about us, and we highly appreciate it, and it helps get the word out so that we can do ever better and awesome things because of our growing audience. So so that's just a little way you can help support mm-hmm. the Tolkien Road.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for our weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for our YouTubers, those watching us on YouTube. So we got to do another one. This is the single Air 5. Remember, YouTubers, you can get the double up Air 5 if you become a patron. So, But we love you on YouTube, so here's the single, right? 3, 2, 1. Whoops, there we go. Nice.
Yes.
All right. You too can become a part of the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5. Just head on over to YouTube where this episode is posted. While you're over there, subscribe to our channel. Like the videos, like all of the videos. Like, check out all the our growing library of videos over there. Drop us a line. Just say, hey, what's up? Air 5 is back in the comments on the episode you're watching, right? So
it's even an Air 5 emoji.
Oh, yeah. Right on. Or you can just say, hey, Air 5 back at you, right, in the
that
comments.
Works too.
Perfectly acceptable. We mm-hmm. like that. So
can you do GIFs on the
Not really. I think
YouTube?
It's mostly just text. They may allow some. I think they allow emojis, but I'm not 100% sure, actually.
Oh, okay.
They don't allow a lot of, stylizing of text or responses over there. So
gotcha. Okay. Well,
but we got a lot of great YouTube comments, and we're going to hit some of those with our correspondence at the end of the episode.
Ooh, fun.
I recently posted my latest video, The Silmarillion, Three Big Problems and How to Fix Them. Had some good discussion on that over there. Going to be reading some comments in response to that one. And I want to go ahead and read this this comment from Timothy D. This is he left this on July 5th. I thought this was really good. Timothy said, "I hope this happens. It saddens me when fellow Tolkien fans speak poorly of the Silmarillion, but they make fair points. All three of John's points are good, although the frame narrative with hobbits is probably the most important. It would also be the hardest to pull off because it would require fans to embrace the inclusion of fan-made material in the Silmarillion. If someone were to make a revised Silmarillion, they should also take advantage of Christopher Tolkien's later publications to make better editorial decisions in the narrative itself than he did in 1977. Unfinished Tales, The History of Middle-earth, and the standalone Great Tales. For example, Christopher Tolkien later regretted his heavy-handed editing in Of the Ruin of Doriath. He presents a restored version of this story in the standalone Beren and Lúthien. Also, there is an argument that Quaintus Silmarillion should end with a prophecy by Mondos about the Dagor Dagorath. The exclusion of this alters the eschatology and overall tone and mood of the end of Quaintus Silmarillion." So, good stuff, Timothy, and a lot of really worthy topics for discussion. You know, you just dropped in there. Yeah, I mean, I really believe we're at the point is Tolkien. I think what Christopher did in giving us like this entire history, almost like textual criticism of his own work and of his father's work, was huge in laying the groundwork for being able to do. For others to be able to come in later on and expand upon Tolkien's work in a way that's a little bit more direct and, you know, and just gets to the, you know, gets back to actual storytelling, right? I'm okay with that. Now, I mean, I'd want to see it executed well, but I'm not a fan of Tolkien that's just like, if Tolkien didn't write it, then I don't want to read it. It's, for me, it's like, we have the means to hold publishers, writers, whoever wants to dabble in Middle Earth, we have the means to hold them accountable in the future, right? So somebody can't just come in and be like, "We're gonna make millions, billions, I tell you, off of Middle Earth, not off of Middle Earth." I don't know what that impression is. Some kind of mid 20th century, capitalist guy in New York City, I guess.
Oh, I thought it was like a newspaper boy.
Something like that, right? No, that wasn't England. No.
Okay. Sorry.
No, I'm purely being offensive to my fellow Americans with that accent. I love that we have this stuff from Christopher so that we can, you know, we can hold the people who dabble in Middle Earth in the future accountable to what Christopher and ultimately J.R.R. Tolkien actually desired for this, you know, for this universe. So I think there's a lot of openness, but I think there's a lot. I think Tolkien himself would have been okay with that in the end, just based on some different things he said. But anyway, I digress. It's a long, much longer discussion, one that's going to be continuing for a while. I, for one, do hope that we can find a way to do more works in Middle Earth in the future, right? That stays true to what Tolkien wanted ultimately. That's my greatest desire for that. All right. Well, thanks for a great comment, Timothy. Mm-hmm. And like I said, head on over to YouTube, you know, watch this on YouTube, right? And go over there and drop us some comments over there. Really want to, you know, really trying to do more on YouTube these days. And, you know, and so the more people who are over there subscribing, watching the videos, helping us out, the more I can do, the more I can devote time, you know, to spending over there and creating some cool videos. So, yeah.
All right. Cool.
Right on.
YouTube it, baby.
YouTube it.
Yeah.
All right, Greta.
Yeah.
You ready to set us straight on our calabath?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
I thought that was pretty clever.
That's actually really clever. Well, I'm gonna do my best.
All right.
I'm gonna do my best.
Well, let me introduce this real quick for people. All right, while we're doing this. All right. So, back in early April, we got a note from listener Paul M. And in this note, you know, there's a good amount of information in this note, but Paul referred back, I guess, to maybe our first time through a calabath. And he asked, does Greta still find the first part of A Calabaith boring, or does she now realize it is the greatest piece of writing Tolkien ever did? And that sort of led to this thing where we, you know, I think Greta, somehow we got this into our minds that we were going to, that Greta was going to lead a discussion of A Calabaith. And for the life of us, Greta and I both were like, how did this happen?
How did I get here? But
it happened, and, you know, we agreed to it on air, so...
So we're stuck.
Yeah.
So
here you are, stuck with Greta leading a reread of A Calabaith. So I don't know if it'll be too much of a a reread of the whole thing as much as it is a Greta's chance to highlight some things and talk about from her perspective instead of me being the one blabbing on and then Greta interjecting some clever things. So.
Right. Now you'll just get your mind blown constantly because I won't be interjecting. I'll actually just be monologuing.
Yeah, it'll just be one just be complete. My head is going to maybe explode. Another reason to watch on YouTube, right?
Oh, so. I don't know that they want to see that. Yeah. But anyway, it's kind of funny, I guess, as we segue into the main part of the episode here. Because as I was rereading and preparing, I was, I asked John, I was like, how did I get myself into this? Like, what kind of spurred this on? And when he reread me Paul M's note, I had to kind of chuckle because at that point I was, maybe not quite halfway through my reread. And the thought had literally just gone through my brain of, when is this going to get exciting? This is so boring. And
Ruh-roh, Paul.
Sorry, Paul. And it's not that obviously Tolkien wrote it, so the writing is beautiful and amazing. There's just not a whole lot of action at the beginning.
Right.
And I'm kind of, I don't know if it's a touch of ADHD or if it's just my general impatience in general. It's got to grab me pretty quick. Now, I am also a very, what's the right word? I'm very competitive with myself and I'm an overachiever. And so even if I will not quit a book to save my life. I feel like that's an epic failure on my part. Mm-hmm. So it's this weird kind of contradiction, I guess, where even if a book doesn't grab me, I'm still going to finish it because if I don't, I see it as a failure on my part.
Yeah, that's something I know about you for sure is that you've gotten through some massive books because you refused to stop. You were just like, I really wish I was reading something else, but I'm going to finish this.
I'm going to finish this, doggone it.
Which I find admirable, honestly, because I'm not like that. I'm like, I have a lot of shiny object syndrome where I'm just like, I do finish books eventually, but I just get, let's go look at this over here, which you kind of probably understand if you've been following this podcast since its beginning, as we kind of have shiny object syndrome sometimes. But anyway, I digress.
But anyway, so I guess, Paul, just the quick answer to your initial question was I'm afraid I do find the first part of A Calabaith a little boring. Now, that's not to say that I don't enjoy the writing, and I enjoyed rereading it. It was a good refresher, but I just prefer more action. Mm-hmm. Now, once the action started going, I was like, this is great. This is great.
Yeah.
But the first part, just not, it was a little bit of a slog for me.
I can understand that. I mean, I kind of like that. I like that balance of style, I guess. And I am a fan of the elaborate stage setting of, explaining the 2,000 years of history leading up to when the action really starts, but
it has a place. It definitely has a place, and I think we need that. We kind of need that framework,
sure,
for sure. But anyway, I was as I was rereading, it was we've already obviously deep dived into Al-Calabaith
a few times actually.
And so my point here is not to rehash all of that, but like John said, just kind of pull out some things that really stuck out to me this time, and especially because we've done a lot more exploration of the Second Age mm-hmm. since we did Al-Khalibeth the first time.
Can I say something real quick?
Yes.
So one of the things that is so great about Tolkien that I've realized over the course of doing this podcast is that no matter how many times you read and discuss a lot of his works, you can just keep coming back to them. Maybe not, you know, every episode, but it's like you can keep coming back to them and just finding so much new, like so many things that you maybe didn't notice before, so many details, because that's how good his writing is, right? That's the power of his imagination mm-hmm. that he mm-hmm. that in this imaginary world that he bequeathed to us. So
yes, no, I completely agree. I enjoyed this reread of it probably more because it's been filled out for me. Like I know a lot more of because this obviously Al-Khalibeth is just kind of an overview, mm-hmm. right? It's just kind of a short story of how Numenor came to not be anymore.
A short story of a 3,000 year period.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But we've discussed, you know, a lot of the stuff that's been happening at that same time mm-hmm. since then. So anyway, so the first part, like we said, is just kind of that stage setting. And I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly as far mm-hmm. as why Numenor even came to be in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it was basically because of Arendil. Is that correct?
Yeah, Arendil.
Arendil. He after the battle between Morgoth and the Valar, mm-hmm. The Valar were not pleased with men and elves because they hadn't fought as valiantly as they wanted to. Is right. that correct? And so Arendil took it on himself to go talk to the Valar.
Well, right. So he's the only mortal man to have ever stepped foot into the Blessed Realm, and because of his great, like, daring voyage to seek the aid of the Valar, right? And so
why did they need the aid in the first place? That's what I didn't understand.
Because Morgoth was basically, like, he had basically taken over all of Beleriand. Like, they, you know, all of the, you know, you think about in the First Age, like, all of those realms of, you know, you've got like Doriath, you've got Gondolin, you've got Nargothrond, and other places. And all these places at this point had pretty much been overrun and they were kind of pushed back to the coasts, right? So it was a very, like, the free peoples of Middle Earth were in great peril at that time.
Gotcha.
Right?
Gotcha.
So.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so Numenor, it wasn't just Arendil, but it was, you know, it was like, I mean, he was the one that got the Lords of the, you know, the West to send aid, right? And to finally defeat Morgoth. But it, you know, the Edain, right? Were the elf friends, right? Were the men, were the elf friends among men, right?
Right.
Who aided the elf, the Noldor and others in their struggle against Morgoth in the First Age. Okay. And that's why they're the people who were rewarded with Numenor.
With Numenor. Okay. Okay, so Arendil's quest was to get the Valar to help them mm-hmm. fight Morgoth. And then the island of Numenor was a reward to the Edain for helping the elves.
That's right.
Fight mm-hmm. Morgoth. Okay. That makes sense. And Arendil never, like, we don't know what happened to him. Do we?
Well, he's set. The star, right? That travels through the sky.
Yes.
Well, no, that's his ship, right? So it's got the Silmaril on the prow, right? On the bow. I'm not sure if I'm getting my nautical terms right. Bad former sailor. I was a submariner, people. So anyway, Yarendel, yeah, so he's like in the, you know, his ship is in the sky and it's got the Silmaril, and so that's the star, right?
Right. So that's but him he himself was never seen again after went to Valinor.
Right.
Right? And
Yeah, he doesn't come back. Yeah.
Right, he doesn't come back. Okay. But his sons, we learn, or we knew, I guess, already, are Elros mm-hmm. and Elrond.
That's right.
And we know Elrond from Lord of the Rings, obviously. And Elros is the first king of Numenor. And we learn that the Numenorians, aptly enough, are very great shipbuilders.
Mm-hmm.
And they are masters of the sea. And they love to sail. But they're not allowed to go wherever they want.
Right.
The Valar put a ban mm-hmm. on them. And they're only allowed to travel east,
That's
not
right.
west. And this just kind of got me thinking of bands in general.
Yeah.
And kind of, I feel like a lot of times they're like a catch 22. Because, I mean, as I read this, I was like, that's really, this ban was kind of what caused all of the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And not that, I'm not saying bands are bad. But sometimes they are not, they're complicated, mm-hmm. right? Because it's obviously this whole ban is very reminiscent of the episode in Genesis
mm-hmm.
where Adam and Eve are said, you can eat of whatever tree you want, just not this one.
Right.
Just not this one. And the Valar obviously had a good reason
mm-hmm.
for putting this ban in place. But, the funny thing about us humans, about us mortals, is that when we're told not to do something or that we can't have something, it makes us want to do that thing or to have that particular thing even more.
Right.
So what is your take on this ban? Why do you think the Valar put this ban in place in the first place?
Well, I mean, the reason it's indicated in the text is that essentially men can, it would be wrong for men, it would be harmful for men, for the men themselves to step foot upon the undying lands, right? And it all goes back to this idea that like that's not Iluvatar's will for men, right? To be, you know, to dwell in Arda in an undying fashion, right?
Right.
So I guess that seems to be the rub. I mean, I find this theme to be like the most, like one of the most fascinating things about the entire story of Numenor is this whole dynamic of, you know, what is the fate of men, right? Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. shrouded from men,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's mm-hmm. the whole that's the problem of men in Middle Earth in general. And I mean, essentially to me, that's the problem of men for in reality in our real earth, right? So anyway, yeah.
No, I think you're right, and so obviously this ban was put in place for the protection
mm-hmm.
of the Numenorians, right? And for a time they were cool with it. They were like, that's fine, we got everything we need right here. I mean, Numenor was, it was a paradise. I mean,
yeah.
they it was beautiful and lush and I mean, just living on an island, it doesn't get much better than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially an island that sounds like Numenor,
right?
For sure.
Yeah. And then they, you know, one of the most beautiful things, I guess, about the island was that they had, they got Nimloth, which was a seed of the white tree of mm-hmm. Valinor. So even though they couldn't get to Valinor, they had a little piece of Valinor, right? Mm-hmm. Like on Numenor. So it seems like that would be good, you know, be like, okay, well, this obviously the Valar are smarter than we are. And they had good reason for putting this ban in place, but they were also kind enough to give us a little piece of their home.
Sure.
And so they have Nimloth and then they do travel east to Middle Earth. And they're kind of, I think we said in past episodes, they were like missionaries, right?
Yeah.
They were really, they kind of went as helpers and teachers
mm-hmm.
initially and really blessed the Middle Earth people. But alas, the tide begins to turn and they begin to feel discontent.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, you know, why that was, what kind of initially sowed that seed of discontent. I didn't know if it was because they were traveling to Middle Earth
mm-hmm.
and they, you know, they, because basically what they wanted was they were jealous of the Valar's and the elves' immortality,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they kind of wanted, my note here says that they wanted the best of both worlds. Like they wanted all the things that they had on their island, but they also wanted to live forever.
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about this quite a bit too in the past about immortality is actually not quite the gift mm-hmm. that it seems to be on the surface.
Right.
It's almost like a prison mm-hmm. of sorts. Like they're kind of, there's no escape.
Yeah.
Really for them. And what path, there was a passage in here actually that, that really stuck out to me. I'm just going to read it real quick if that's okay. Cause I thought there was a lot of really good,
your discussion,
really good stuff in here. So this is still toward the beginning, I guess, of Al-Khalabeth, and it's, after the Numenoreans have begun to feel discontent, and they basically have started to grumble and let their complaints and discontent, they've let it known mm-hmm. to the Valar. And so the Valar send messengers to Numenor to kind of have a little bit of a council, a little powwow of sorts. And this is what they say. So basically they're talking about this mortality versus immortality issue, and the messengers from Valinor are saying, as says, the Eldar, you say, are unpunished, and even those who rebelled do not die. Yet that is to them neither reward nor punishment, but the fulfillment of their being. They cannot escape and are bound to this world, never to leave it so long as it lasts, for its life is theirs. And you are punished for the rebellion of men, you say, in which you had small part, and so it is that you die. But that was not at first appointed for a punishment. Thus you escape and leave the world, and are not bound to it in hope or in weariness. Which of us, therefore, should envy the others? And the Numenoreans answered, why should we not envy the Valar, or even the least of the deathless? For of us is required a blind trust, and a hope without assurance, knowing not what lies before us in a little while. And yet we also love the earth, and would not lose it. Then the messenger said, indeed, the mind of Iluvatar concerning you is not known to the Valar, and he has not revealed all things that are to come. But this we hold to be true, that your home is not here, neither in the land of Aman, nor anywhere within the circles of the world. And the doom of men, that they should depart, was at first a gift of Iluvatar. It became a grief to them only because, coming under the shadow of Morgoth, it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness of which they were afraid, and some grew willful and proud and would not yield until life was reft from them. We who bear the ever-mounting burden of the years do not clearly understand this, but if that grief has returned to trouble you, as you say, then we fear that the shadow arises once more and grows again in your hearts. Therefore, though you be the Dunedain, fairest of men, who escaped from the shadow of old and fought valiantly against it, we say to you, beware. The will of Eru may not be gainsaid, and the Valar bid you earnestly not to withhold the trust to which you are called, lest soon it become again a bond by which you are constrained. Hope, rather, that in the end even the least of your desires shall have fruit. The love of Arda was set in your hearts by Iluvatar, and he does not plant to no purpose. Nonetheless, many ages of men unborn may pass ere that purpose is made known, and to you it will be revealed, and not to the Valar. I just, like, I mean, it's kind of like a moment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was almost like I was reading scripture. Like, there's so much in there. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like the Numenoreans got, you know, I feel like, I hope that the messengers kind of like dropped a mic and walked away after that. Like, what else needs to be said? Like,
right.
Clearly, I mean, but you can sympathize with the Numenoreans, mm-hmm. right? You can understand if you look at someone that can live forever and you're like, oh, and I have to die. Like, that's not fair.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So you can sympathize with them, but it was just interesting to me that the messengers make it clear that really it was the reason it becomes, you know, what this gift of mortality, this mortality is meant to be a gift. And the reason it became a grief to them was it because he says it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness. Like it was clearly their own perception.
Mm-hmm.
What stuck out to you about this?
I mean, I remember, I think I, you know, highlighted that passage again. I think every time I've read it, I've highlighted that passage because it is so powerful, and it gets to the, I think it really gets to the heart of the story of Numenor, and which is, you know, this tension and the, you know, I think the Eldar exist as this foil for men.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the story in the end, you know, seems to be about the secondborn, right? You know, the weak ones, right? Is kind of the elves see them at first when they first discover men, and the, you know, the fact that they die, like, you know, with just, they're frail compared to elves. Mm-hmm. Right. And, but it's so, I don't know. I read that and it's so interesting because I think of Tolkien's own comments about Lord of the Rings and his conscious decision to connect the destruction of the ring to the date of both, you know, of at least the incarnation, right? The incarnation of Christ, which has traditionally been March 25th, and then, but even around the same date being, you know, quite possibly the day of the crucifixion as well, right? Mm-hmm. And so that last little bit there, where, let me see,
okay, go ahead.
Gotta pull the book. This book is copy of Silmarillion is falling apart here, people. All right, not my only copy, but this is the one I've used over the years. So, hope rather, many ages of men unborn may pass ere that purpose is made known, and to you it will be revealed, and not to the Valar. So, mm-hmm. to me, this is like Iluvatar's, like Tolkien is basically, like, what does that mean? I can't help but think that it's anything other than Tolkien is again alluding to the fact that this all takes place as a mythological history for our own world. Mm-hmm. And that, as he says in On Fairy Stories, the great eucatastrophe of history is the incarnation, and the great eucatastrophe of the incarnation is the resurrection, right? So it's all for Tolkien building up to, you know, the story of Christ, to the story of Iluvatar becoming man. Right? Mm. that's this great mystery that hasn't even been revealed to the Valar, you know, at this point. And I love the line right before that, by the way. The love of Arda was set in your hearts by Iluvatar, and he does not plant to no purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So it's okay that you're here and that you love this world. And, like, you should, right? This world is a good place. It was made for you. And the love of it was put into your hearts by Iluvatar. And Iluvatar does not plant seeds without a purpose, right? So again, you have this seed of, like, the future, that what is the fate of men ultimately? Well, it's not to just die and be dead forever, right? But it's ultimately to, you know, if what I identified about, you know, about this story being a, you know, precursor of, you know, kind of prophesying the incarnation vaguely there, and the resurrection, then, you know, then what it's talking about is the resurrection of men, right? The resurrection of life, the recreation of the world, right? You know, the new heavens and the new earth, right? That the world would be remade and perfected and no longer subject to futility and decay. So
yeah, boom, absolutely. And I think what you know, like I said, you can, as far as the Numenoreans go, we can really relate to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what, you know, basically their complaint is, for us is required a blind trust and a hope without assurance. And I feel like that's something that we struggle, you know, that as humans we struggle with on mm-hmm. the daily, a blind trust. And I mean, the whole hope without assurance, I think that was, this might be a little dramatic. And that's probably what inspired this, you know, the next bit that comes from the messengers. He's trying to give them hope. And I think that hope, so much of our hope comes when we are drawn out of our our little myopic reality, and we're blessed with a more eternal perspective.
Right.
And I think that's what the messenger's trying to do here, is kind of pull the Numenoreans out of their little island, if you will, and just kind of be like, okay, let's look a little broader here, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, I love that. I love that line too about, you know, that Iluvatar does not plant to no purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of, I love too that he says, your home is not here.
Mm-hmm.
And that reminded me of, I think it's Teresa of Avila. I think it's Teresa of Avila basically said, this world is thy ship, not thy home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like this is kind of a stepping stone, right, to prepare us for what is to come. And and the seed that was planted by Iluvatar is something that helps, you know, that's meant to help us make the Numenors. And it's funny, I didn't think about this, but the Numenoreans being shipbuilders and men and, you know,
yeah.
Seafarers
and being descended from the great seafarer, right? The greatest seafarer, Eärendil, yeah, right?
Exactly. So maybe if they had just looked at, you know, looked at the earth as their ship,
mm-hmm.
not their home, maybe that would have, I think that would have been a really worthwhile perspective.
Maybe you wouldn't have just had the island sink into the sea, people. Right,
maybe you could have saved your home. But anyway, I think that was probably like my favorite part of Akelebi. It's just jammed. That just one section is just so jam packed.
Absolutely.
Anyway, moving on. Mm-hmm. They talk about this 13th king is brought into the story shortly after.
Right.
And his name is Atonimir.
Atonimir.
Atonimir. And they describe him as clinging to his life beyond the end of all joy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's so sad. That's so sad. And clinging to life is not a bad thing in and of itself.
Right.
Right. It's just that beyond the end of all joy,
mm-hmm.
Was just kind of the piece that really hit home. And, you know, at this point, Numenor has been around for like 2,000 years, right? Because mm-hmm. he's the 13th king. And we know that the Numenoreans live a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's the 13th king, there's been lots of years have passed. So I'm just wondering, so is the really the cause of all this discontent coming up now? Is it really the shadow? Is that purely what's causing it, you think? It seems like things have been so good for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I think the shadow, like the shadow, is a really interesting concept in within Middle Earth, right? Within Tolkien's lore, because it can refer to like kind of Sauron's sway. I feel like it does a lot of times in Lord of the Rings when they're talking about, you know, the return of the shadow or the shadow of the past, right? But it also, I think, even in Akalabeth, when he refers to the shadow, he's almost talking about just the shadow of death, right? The great Psalm 23, you know, translation of Psalm 23, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, right? Mm-hmm. For men, that's the shadow that's referred to a lot in Akalabeth. And there's this, that is a great, great little image of that king drawn out, you know, that you draw out there, right? That of, he did not, what does he say? He did not want to, he didn't like depart from this life willing. He like held on beyond joy, yeah, right?
Clinging to his life beyond the end of all joy.
Beyond the end of all joy. And I just think of, you know, my father passing away a couple of months ago this year and being there with him during that time. And I just think like, you know, like he did not, that was not him. Like that, like what I'm saying is like that, I know what Tolkien is saying there, because my father, he knew it was his time. Right. And we recognized that. And and he was able to accept that, I think, in large part because of his own faith and his own trust in the Redeemer, right? His own trust in his own belief in the resurrection, right? And we as a family were able to, as sad as we were able to not just want to be like, oh, we got to hang on for until like his last breath. He could release himself, we could release him, right? And so, yeah, I think it's really interesting that Tolkien draws that out there, that he was holding on to life beyond all joy, like it was this fear, like it was just like, I don't want to go into the abyss, right? You know, it's like, just this refusal to want to go into the abyss, this willfulness. And so I think it's this turning point, like this death of this king is this turning point in the history of Numenor to say, like, they had lost the faith, the light of the West. And I am of a strong opinion that Numenor was, the story of Numenor is a fundamentally religious one. All right. It is they were there, they worshiped Iluvatar, right? That was their purpose on this mountain. And then they were supposed to take the knowledge of Iluvatar and the hope of the West, that there is hope for men beyond the shadow, right? Beyond the shadow of death. They were supposed to take that into the east, to all of the men who had fallen under the sway of Morgoth, who had fallen under the despair of the shadow of death. Mm-hmm. And they were to take that to them and encourage them and enlighten them, right? And you know, ultimately that's what they fail in, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think you are definitely spot on there. And it's really the, they begin to neglect their fundamental religious practices.
Mm-hmm.
They stop going up to the Minotaur.
Minotaur, yep.
Yep. And once you do that, it's just like this slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we can see that in so many things, right? You're just one little failure, right? And just open the door to so many other issues.
I'll just say real quick, if I can interject briefly.
I'll allow it.
I think this is something you'd agree with. Like, you know, as Catholics, we have a an obligation to attend Mass at least once a week, right? And it's a sin not to attend, right? Not to attend on the, on Sunday, right? And then other holy days of obligation. But the point is, it's a sin because you're harming yourself, right? You need to go and get back in touch with God. You need to be in the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, in order to heal yourself from the wounds of the week, right? Of the week that's transpired. And when you get out of that cycle, you lose sight of hope. The grace that comes to you, you're not able to apprehend it as you would before. But when you do, it's always such a, most 99% of the time for me, it's a refreshing experience. It puts everything back into perspective, mm-hmm. right?
It really does.
All of the struggles, all of the garbage of the week, right? You're just able to lay there and, mm-hmm. and be renewed.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think of that with this Minotaur thing, right? That they don't, mm-hmm. they stop going to the Minotaur and carrying out the religious practices, that they had been carrying on since the beginning of Numenor. And again, just another, it's another marker in that decline, right?
It is. Yeah. Cause they stop going to the Minotaur and then, the next thing you know, they begin to, neglect the white tree. The white tree is not tended the way it should be, which is really the white tree was like the symbol of their heritage,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it was literally descended from a tree in Valinor, and once that starts to go, I mean, it's literally just kind of a, you know, it's like a snowball effect,
mm-hmm.
and this got me thinking, like, practically, what is my white tree? What is your white tree? What is the thing in your life that, if you, once you, you know, if you neglect it, is kind of the beginning of the end, mm-hmm. right? For lack of, I mean, not to be overly dramatic, but we all have that. Mm-hmm. And depending on what it is, you know, it needs to be tended in a certain yeah. way. And there's so many, I mean, I could think of so many things, and maybe it's not just one thing. It's maybe it's several things, but as Christians, as Catholics, I think probably prayer is, you know, just keeping that open line of communication, keeping that line of communication open. It's the more foundational something is, the less it takes to undermine it. It's just little, even just the smallest little neglects mm-hmm. can really wreak havoc.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Do you understand what I'm trying to say about like
yeah.
that white tree?
I think you're calling out the, what I hear is the power of like some, like the symbols and the rituals of, yes. you know, of religion and when keeping one close to meaning, mm-hmm. right? Close mm-hmm. to the meaning of, you know, that you're here for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, something that's, something that attracted me to Catholicism in the first place was the sacramentality, was the, you know, the just rife with symbolism everywhere. And just, you just go deeper and deeper mm-hmm. into that stuff over the years as you, you know, see more and more of it. So,
yeah. And I think this relates nicely back to what we were talking about earlier about the ban and how they can often be seen as a renouncement of freedoms mm-hmm. of sort, like when you were talking about the obligation to go to Mass every Sunday. You know, I've heard people say, oh, I'm not Catholic because I value my freedom. And you're like, well, you know, and I can understand that, you know, because there's lots of obligations mm-hmm. that, you know, not just in Catholic faith, but you have an obligation to family, you have so many obligations in your life. And they can be seen, like mm-hmm. just like this ban on traveling west can easily be seen as, you know, as an attack on freedom. But it's really, and I've noticed this about myself, especially recently, is those boundaries are healthy things. Like, because mm-hmm. we need, like, some of us more than others, like, we need kind of a little, we need those guardrails. I'm a terrible bowler, like, terrible. So I always am like, can I please have the guardrails up? But, you know, I just think about that. It's like, just, you know, to be totally cheesy with a bowling analogy here, like, they keep you from going into the gutter. Like,
yeah.
You know? So, anyway, and I'm guilty of seeing these bans as, you know, as an infringement on my freedom, for sure. But again, once we kind of take ourselves outside of ourselves and we search and we make it a point to have an eternal perspective, I think, you know, that's or even a broader perspective for yeah. that matter, it can really
well, it seems to me that that's what happened with the Numenoreans is over time, like, you know, maybe a virtue of the gift of giving them the longer life excuse me, was that it gave more time to, like, Elros, and they, you know, so he lived like 500 years, right? He was king for like over 400 years, and you know, you think about that, and they gave him the time to establish at the heart of Numenor this knowledge of, like, you know, the hopeful perspective, right? The perspective of friendship with the West, but understanding that the West is not for us, right? The blessed realm is not for men, right? Mm-hmm. But we do have an ultimate destiny that lies beyond, you know, the shadow of this world, right? And the shadow of death. You had these kings carrying that forward, but as time went on, even for them, they lost that perspective, right? They lost touch with these traditions. They became not living traditions, but, you know, maybe these empty things, those are just stories that, you know, that were told us, but, you know, let's be real, right? This world is all there is, mm-hmm. right? You know, that seems to have been like kind of the change in perspective over time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, another thing that hit me too was a common theme in this work is fear, and how fear can really have so many different effects. Because here it clearly says that prior to the neglect of mental dharma, it says that the Numenoreans, it says, and if they loved the Valar no longer, at least they still feared them.
Mm-hmm.
So they still, and that's not ideal, obviously. It'd be good to love and fear the Valar. But at least they still feared them. At least they were still like, okay, at least, we shouldn't anger them.
Mm-hmm.
They're still mighty beings. But once that fear, once they kind of started to lose that, even that fear, that's when things really started to go haywire.
Well, I will say, though, again, if I can interject, that makes me think of like fear. When it becomes that kind of fear, right? Not a respect and power, but when it transitions into just this fear, yes, it may keep people in line for a little while. But ultimately, what they're doing in the back of their minds, even as they're being kept in line by that fear, is being like, "How do I get out from under this fear?" Right? They want to run away from what they perceive to be the cause of the fear, and eventually even to lash out at it. Right? That's just the dynamic that's going to happen if there's not the renewal of trust. That will allow for a healthier form of, of respect, then it's just going to turn into ultimately, some form of rebellion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because they're looking to escape that emotion of fear. Cause that's not a comfortable place to be.
Mm-mm.
And that's what we see once they, everything starts to change once they lose that love of the Valar and it transitions to just that fear. That's when they begin to treat the people of Middle Earth differently, right? Mm-hmm. They don't go as teachers and helpers. They go as they want to be masters and lords of Middle Earth. And so they basically themselves want to be gods. Like they want to be like the Valar. And that's why they stop going to the mental dharma, because that's a clear recognition that, oh, we're not gods. They're the gods. And that's why we're going. And so they stop going because they themselves want to be the Valar.
Yes.
Right? But it's clearly it can't be. It's only at best it's going to be a mockery of what the Valar are. Right? Because they're just that is not their purpose. That was not what Iluvatar created them for.
Right.
We need to wrap this up.
Well, are you getting pretty good on everything you wanted to get through?
Yeah,
I was going to say, if you have a lot more, we can always, come back and do a second round in a couple of weeks.
No, I think that's really, I have lots of notes here, but I think they were mostly for my own clarity of mind to try to remember the, because it is kind of a lot going on.
I love that you picked, this theme of, of the theme that you picked, right? Of the shadow of death, basically, and the role that plays in the history of Numenor, right?
Yeah.
I thought Paul's original question, right, was about the first part. And really, that's what you covered, right? That's what you hit.
Okay.
And I think I'm hearing in your voice, even though you said, yeah, it's a little boring, at the same time I'm hearing in your voice, but it may not be action-packed, but you have a new appreciation for it.
I think you're absolutely right. Yep. I think that hits the nail on the head.
I think it's understandable why you and many others might find it boring initially, but once you have kind of gotten the full scope and you've immersed yourself more deeply into the lore of Middle Earth, it's something you can appreciate a whole lot more, right? And especially in my mind, when you understand all of the connections and the things that were important to Tolkien on a personal level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his overall view of the world, of history, all of these things it all ties back, right? And it helps you get a clearer picture of what the whole story of Middle Earth is about in the first place, right? This dynamic of immortality versus mortality. You've got the elves as foils as foils to what we experience as men, and you realize, oh wait, that immortality in this world thing is, it maybe ain't all it's cracked up to be, right?
Right.
And you know, maybe there is, maybe death is truly, you know, was the gift, right? Is the gift of Iluvatar to us, and but it's not the final word either, right?
It's not. And what I think what struck me too was the again, it's that element of fear. It's when they begin to fear death that it really, you know, begins to be seen as a grief mm-hmm. and not a gift. Because later in the text, it makes it clear that death, like death, what they wanted, what Iluvatar's will for the Numenoreans was a happy death. Like mm-hmm. he wanted them to go peacefully. And what we see is, that's what goes away, mm-hmm. right? That the clinging to life beyond the end of all joy,
yes.
that's not a happy death. And this whole idea of a happy death was something that was really kind of foreign to me
mm-hmm.
until we became Catholic. And now, you know, now that I've, especially I think of your dad's passing away, which was probably because it was the most recent. But I think he had a very happy death, and it's very clear when that there is such a thing as a happy mm-hmm. death, and it seems a little bit of a contradiction in terms, right?
Yeah.
How can death be happy? And I can still remember being a teenager at my grandfather's funeral, and my uncle got up there and said, "Oh, woohoo! You know, Dad's in heaven. Let's party!" And I was like, "I don't want to party. I miss my grandpa." You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a balance, obviously, that needs mm-hmm. to be struck. But death, like a life lived well, and then, and you know, culminating in a happy death, that's what the will of Iluvatar was for the Numenoreans. And yeah, once they started to, you know, to neglect kind of their foundation
mm-hmm.
of that went away.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe it wouldn't hurt to do a second episode maybe at some point.
Okay.
Because I do have still quite a few notes.
Save your notes. I mean, I just don't want to see your work. You did a great job, and I don't want to see your work go to waste. And I mean, let's be honest, you're the fan favorite here, so between the two of us. So, okay. Well, I mean, I'm your biggest fan, so.
Aww.
So anyway, I think we can definitely come back to this and, you know, and so just remember where you left off, and let's come back and let's do a second part at some point, you know, in the not too distant future.
That sounds like a plan.
Right on.
Yeah, this was fun.
See, you're going to, like, now that you've done it, like, you've gotten through that first time of being the person on the spot to answer all, you know, to, like, lead the discussion, I think I've probably created a monster out of you.
I don't know. It actually, I was going to say, I have much more of appreciation for all the time and energy that you put into episode prep, because I got used to just showing up. And
finally, I feel appreciated.
It is a lot
after
of
all
work,
these years.
But it's very rewarding. Like I felt very scholarly.
You did a great job.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank Paul M for, you know, asking the question, which kind of spurred all this on.
Air five to Paul M. There you go.
Yes. So thank you. And let's do plan on doing a second part at some point.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
We shall do that.
Okay. Cool.
All right, y'all. Well, let's do a little correspondence. So first, I want to, we had a tweet recently from user Lou Petite Therapist, I think is what it is. One of them crazy Twitter names, Twitter handles. So Lou said, "Hi, I have started listening to your podcast on Spotify, but chapters 9, 10, and 11 are not there. Any reason why? Where else could I listen to them? Loving the Tolkis love." This is going back in our history. Yeah. So, well, thanks, Lou. I will say I don't know why that would be the case on Spotify. I do know that with the first several episodes, I kind of did this weird thing where I did things out of order or I released them out of order. So I'm not sure if that's what happened. I'll have to look into it, though. But if there's any other Spotify listeners who have noticed this problem as well and figured out a solution, please feel free to reach out to me and I can get the communication over to Lou, or you can just head over to Twitter and communicate with Lou directly. But anyway, so yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but I'll look into it and get back to you. All right. So we have a few emails to hit. The first is from Marilyn. Back on June 7th. Marilyn, this is titled Rings and Such. Hello, Carswells. I thought you might like Morgoth's Ring, as you said, enough material there for a few interesting series. I know many folks think of Sauron's ring as a Horcrux, but I see it differently. Sauron put some of his spiritual essence, if you like, into it, but even more, it contained his will to dominate. It could be seen as a tool for focusing, if you will, but domination was its intention. It was not a Horcrux, because Sauron could not die, and so he didn't need anything to tie him to life. He could expend so much of his energy that he would come to a point where he was unable to regenerate a physical form, but he would still exist as a spirit of malice, as Gandalf said. You could say the ring acted as a Horcrux for Barad-dûr, I suppose. Its foundations could not be destroyed as long as the ring survived. But I really don't think that Sauron made the ring for that purpose. I think Marilyn is much more of a Harry Potter expert than I am.
Same.
I remember reading Harry Potter back in the day and the Horcrux thing and not entirely understanding what the Horcrux was. But that's good stuff, and I like the insight there. And I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners who are huge Harry Potter fans as well, and will be able to really appreciate the insight that Marilyn mm-hmm. brings to the table. Mm-hmm. She goes on, the distinction between Aule and his pupils who went bad was that Aule gave away freely all that he made and was delighted when his students took what he created and made it better. No problems with possessiveness there. Yeah, definitely. The whole question of possessiveness is huge mm-hmm. in the whole legendarium. I see the major difference between Morgoth and Sauron as being that Morgoth was a nihilist. He deteriorated so far from his origins as a subcreator of a creator god that in the end, all he wanted was destruction. Sauron, on the other hand, wanted dominion, and you can't dominate if there's nothing and no one there to rule over.
Good point.
Yeah. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Difference between evil minds, right? What they desire, what they truly desire. Mm-hmm. No, Elrond's wife, Celebrion, did not die. She was healed of her poisoned orc wound by Elrond, but she soon grew weary of Middle-earth after that, and so she departed for the Havens, i.e., she didn't get summoned by Mondos because she wasn't dead. Perhaps Elrond's role as a ring-bearer after Gil-galad's death led him to realize he needed to stay around until Sauron was defeated, if that was possible. I think this also explains why Arwen spent so much time in Lothlorien, though really, who needs a reason to spend lots of time in Lothlorien if they can't? True.
Right.
Vacation in Lothlorien, people, I mean, come on. Galadriel was her grandmother, Celebrion's mother, and so her closest female kin. So, I mean, if you could go, like, just live in Lothlorien for a while and, like, get educated by Galadriel, basically, yes, sign me up.
Yeah, I want to go to there.
Yes. And yes, either part in the case of Elvish marriage meant both parties to the marriage had to be consenting.
Okay.
So, yes. So, thanks, Marilyn.
Yes. Fantastic.
Great to hear from you, as always.
Always, yep.
Our next note is from Dan I on June 8th. Dan says, hello, did you guys hear about Billy Boyd and Dom Monaghan's new podcast, The Friendship Onion? It is very funny and nice to hear from Lord of the Rings cast members. So for those of you who may not recall, Billy Boyd and Dom Monaghan played Pippin and Merry, respectively, right, in the Peter Jackson films. And they just launched a new podcast called The Friendship Onion. So I was aware of the podcast, and I have not listened to it yet because I just haven't gotten around to it. But it's definitely was aware of it. Definitely do intend to listen to it at some point. I don't know for our listeners how Lord of the Rings like folk. I don't think it's just about like Lord of the Rings and Tolkien things. I think they have other guests and that kind of thing, and it may be more expansive than that. But obviously, you know, you're talking about the two most famous portrayers of Merry and Pippin. So it's probably going to be a fun podcast, and there's probably going to be plenty of Lord of the Rings fun in there. So anyway, I have not listened to it yet, Dan, but I hope, encourage people to check it out. Also, why do you think Led Zeppelin and Rush both had songs relating to Lord of the Rings, and do you think that Greta Van Fleet will eventually declare themselves as Lord of the Rings nerds through their music? So why do I think Led Zeppelin and Rush both had songs relating to Lord of the Rings? I think that I think that's a reflection of just Tolkien's popularity and like kind of this in the subculture of the 60s and 70s, right? That you know really became kind of the main culture over the last several decades, right? Led Zeppelin, I think it was a pretty common thing to see people who were kind of poetic, artistic types reading like Lord of the Rings, and and getting really invested in, you know, they're the forerunners of all of us listening to this podcast, right? So Robert Plant, you know, with Led Zeppelin, you know, and all the members of Rush, Geddy Lee, who was the drummer that just died? Neil Peart. Neil Peart, I believe, wrote most of the lyrics and is the drummer. I think he wrote a lot of their lyrics, even though Geddy Lee sang them. And I, you know, I know that I think Neil Peart was pretty into, you know, pretty into all this kind of stuff as well. So I just think it was an appreciation for the outlook, and it seems everywhere for us now because fantasy is such a big genre. But back then, what Tolkien was doing was a very unique thing, and I think he just inspired a lot of people, you know, that were artistic mm-hmm. types, you mm-hmm. know. Yeah. In those days. Do I think Greta Van Fleet will eventually declare themselves as Lord of the Rings nerds through their music? I don't know. I'm not sure. So just so you know, Greta, there's a band called Greta Van Fleet.
I know. You know how I figured this out?
How?
When I went, it was like a year ago, we were on a road trip, and I went into Wendy's to like order lunch or something, and they asked for my name for the order, and it was like this teenage boy, and I was like, oh, my name's Greta. And he goes, oh, cool name. And I was like, thanks.
Well, it is
a
cool name.
Why did a teenage boy just compliment me on my name? And then I realized, yeah, I think it was you that told me.
Yeah.
So there's a band with my name.
It is a cool name for sure. Well, and you made it cool before Greta Van Fleet did. Right. Just FYI. So Greta Van Fleet is a band that is a pretty new band, you know, just around in the last 5 or 6 years. And they are, I mean, they're dead ringers for Led Zeppelin. That's the thing, is you'll listen to their music and you'll think, is this some like lost Led Zeppelin album? So do I think they will eventually declare themselves as Lord of the Rings nerds through their music? I guess it's possible. I don't know enough about them myself to know if I think that's likely. I also don't know that would be like back when Led Zeppelin came out, they could do whatever they wanted because there wasn't any kind of expectation or, you know, on the part of, you know, fans that, well, you can only be into these things. It was a much more, I think, open world, and you could just kind of like, you know, whatever interested you, I'm going to write a song about, right? I think bands nowadays, especially when they get to a level of like a Greta Van Fleet, they so often have their image controlled, right? By other interests. And so I don't know. Even if they want to, I don't know that the label would let them be like, well, we don't want to ruin your, you know, your image as like sexy rock gods by having you be like fans of hobbits or something like that, right? But I don't know. I mean, it's possible. If they are, then they should, right? If they're fans of Lord of the Rings, then they should totally make an album that nerds out. They should, right? Because artists should do what inspires them, right? You know, the thing that gets closest to their heart and allows them to bring their joy, the joy of their music, the joy of their creativity to the world, right?
Absolutely. And then that's the difference between something being authentic and being a farce, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're being forced, if someone's forcing on you, telling you what inspires you, then that's, you know, the music is gonna be so much better if it's organic.
Well, exactly. And I was gonna say the flip side of that is if they aren't, but they're like, well, Robert Plant, if they try to ape Led Zeppelin by becoming Lord of the Rings nerds just because Zeppelin had references to Lord of the Rings, then that's messed up. They shouldn't do that, right? Because then it'll be phony.
It will be phony,
right?
Yeah, and I think it'll be kind of obvious in the final product.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Final note, I am rereading Lord of the Rings this summer, and as I'm writing this, I am 3/4 of the way through Fellowship. I'm ashamed to say that I forgot just how awesome this story is. No need to be ashamed,
no
Dan.
No need to be ashamed, nope. Because I was the same. Same.
It's just perpetually amazing.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
It gets better with every read.
It really does.
Great to hear from
you,
Dan.
It's like a fine wine.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A fitting analogy.
Thank you.
The next note is from new patron, Heathen Rohirrim.
That's a cool name.
It is a cool name. Heathen Rohirrim says, hello, John and Greta. Here in my state, we're in lockdown, and I wanted to thank you both for the wonderful backlog of podcasts I'm enjoying during this challenging time. You're legends. Thank you so much.
Oh, that is awesome.
Well, thank you for a legendary note, and I'm glad that we're able to help you through through being in lockdown, and we'll keep them churning, right? And hey, go back and listen the second time around once you get through, right? That's, you know, it's nice that we've got so many episodes up there.
Yep.
You know, so by the time you get to the end, at this point, you can just start back at the beginning and you're good to go. So
yep.
Yeah. All right. And then our last email is from Chris B. And this is on June 27th. So Chris says, "Hi, John. I just found your podcast from your guide to the Silmarillion and was listening to episode 6. You gave a beautiful rationale, not just for your podcast, but for all sorts of podcasts, writings, video posts, etc., regardless of topic. I'm writing because you referenced and paraphrased something C.S. Lewis wrote about how our appreciation of the things we love is only complete when we share it with others. Can you give me the original text for that, or a citation? Thanks so much, Chris." Chris, thanks for the great note. I tried to find my original note. I don't know if I was paraphrasing back then or what, but I could not. See, here's the thing about quoting somebody by like C.S. Lewis is like everything he ever wrote is quotable, and he wrote a lot. So I try to find the exact quote by Googling it, and I get like 10 amazing quotes, and I'm like, but I don't think that was the one I was referencing. So I found one. I found several from The Four Loves, which seems right. The one I linked to here, and I don't know that this was the actual one, but I'm going to go and read this because it was just really good. So this is C.S. Lewis. "For us, of course, the shared activity and therefore the companionship on which friendship supervenes will not often be a bodily one like hunting or fighting. It may be a common religion, common studies, a common profession, even a common recreation. All who share it will be our companions, but one or two or three who share something more will be our friends. And this kind of love, as Emerson says, 'Do you love me?' means, 'Do you see the same truth?' Or at least, 'Do you care about the same truth?' The man who agrees with us that same question, little regarded by others, is of great importance, can be our friend, capital F friend. Mm. He need not agree with us about the answer." Mm. That's it, you know, and so I don't know if that was the actual question, but I feel like that's a good like summary of what we're doing here on this podcast, right? Mm-hmm. With all of you all, right?
Yeah.
We may not always arrive at the same answers, you know, but we all agree that that Tolkien's work is so important and it's so wonderful and it's worth spending all of this time on.
Absolutely.
You know, that's why we're here. But Chris, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let David Bates of Pints with Jack know about this question, and maybe he can help me out. Mm-hmm. I almost never go back and listen to our old episodes, especially going this far back. It's scary to do that when you're the person who created them, because you get really critical of yourself, and especially going way that far back, I'm like, oh man, we would wish that probably we could redo like the first 100 episodes or something like that, right? Because you know, you feel like with something like this, you don't really hit your stride until then. But anyway, I have to think it was from The Four Loves, but David Bates is far more of a C.S. Lewis expert than I am. I'm going to pass this along to him and see if he can, you know, figure out what the exact quote is that I was referencing.
Are we sure it was C.S. Lewis? I mean, it probably was.
I'm almost positive. I think I said it was C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, for some reason, and I don't know why, but when you mentioned that particular quote, I think of something that that we heard at Lord of the Rings, the Over the Rhine concert.
Mm.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Over the Rhine, but they're a husband and wife kind of folksy band. But anyway, I feel like she said something like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, like introducing one of their songs about how, you know, sharing the joy of something. It's just something that's talked about a lot of places. I never remember sermons, guys, ever, but I do remember when we lived in Washington, our pastor talking about that very same thing.
Well, I think that's the C.S. Lewis influence, even with Over the Rhine. Not to say that they're not super smart, because they are. They're incredible artists themselves.
Oh,
but yeah. I know that they were very inspired by, they've been very inspired by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, okay.
What's their first album called? It's a C.S. Lewis reference. It's Till We Have Faces. Is their first their first album is called Till We Have Faces. Yeah.
It's my favorite C.S. Lewis book.
Yeah. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So it must have been C.S. Lewis.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Chris, like I said, I'll pass this along to David Bates of Pints with Jack, and we'll see if we can get you the straight answer. So. All right. All right, a couple of YouTube comments to get to. And let's see. First is from Lefevre's Home on June 12th. A short one, but this is in response to my intro to the Silmarillion Part 2 on Ainulindale and Valaquenta. Reading the Silmarillion is hard, and this show is a wonderful companion piece to have to help keep my mind organized. Boom. Love
that's
it.
That's great. Because that really is, I think, the biggest challenge of the Silmarillion, mm-hmm. is keeping your mind organized. It's
big reason we do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
The next note is from an artist, formerly Nigel, on June 22nd. And this is in response to our very first episode posted. It's just, you know, posted on YouTube. He says, the artist formerly Nigel says, it's a credit to how great Tolkien's work is that so many people have willingly struggled to bring their reading level up to be able to read it.
Mm.
So, yes, indeed. Tribute, you know, it is worth the struggle, right? Yeah, it's worth the struggle to gain that perspective, just like it's worth the struggle to maybe go on a strenuous hike to get to the top of a mountain and mm-hmm. enjoy the incredible views.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely.
Good analogy.
All right. GGQ says, hello, good morning. I think you have very good suggestions and I would pre-order at least two of an updated amended text. So this is in response to the Silmarillion three big problems and how to fix them. Mm. So go over and watch that video. It's my newest video over there. I basically talk about what the problems with the Silmarillion as it's published are and what I hope to see in the future, and right now it's fan fiction, but future edition of the Silmarillion, right? Gigi says, hello, good morning. I think you have very good suggestions, and I would pre-order at least two of an updated amended text. I love maps, but have a horrendous time trying to flip back and forth and get online for clarification. I hate getting my info online. I should be able to have my hands on it. I've had Miss Fonstad's book for the past year and have had difficulty with that too, but it is beautifully hand-drawn and very detailed. I didn't bother to read the preface, so I don't know what percent of drawing are Tolkien's and which ones they are. Bad scholarship on my part. And timelines are so needed. I think that you have outlined exactly what others will also agree are needed. I don't have my copies of the histories yet, but in time they will be present to my humble library. Thanks for your time, Namarie. Mm. Well, thank you for the awesome note there, Gigi.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it, and it's always nice to hear, you know, reflected back my thoughts, because, you know, I was a little worried when I put that one out, like, are people going to think I'm crazy for wanting to do more? I felt pretty, convicted that this, you know, these kinds of things need to happen, and I'm just totally optimistic about the future of, Tolkien stuff, right? Like, with the shows, I'm just really excited to be a Tolkien fan, and, I think it's going to be a lot of fun over the next several years, and I hope to see just the expansion of Tolkien's work mm-hmm. while being true to everything he was about.
For sure.
Vogon Poet on July 1st. I love that name, by the way. Vogon Poet. Do you know what that's a reference to, Greta?
I sure don't.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Of course. 42.
Right. So the Vogons were these evil aliens that destroy Earth. And they're they're poets, but they're really bad poets. So one of their forms of torture for their prisoners was to read their poetry to their prisoners.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That makes me want to read the books.
They're quite humorous. All right. So Vogon Poet 67 says, one in response also to the Silmarillion three big problems, says, one of the things that confused me for years with the Silmarillion maps was how they related to the Lord of the Rings map. Then one day I ran across a blog post or article, I don't remember, and it noted the overlap of the Ered Luin, the Blue Mountains, in both maps. On the Lord of the Rings map, those mountains are at the far west of Eriador near the sea. On the Silmarillion map, they are at the far east of the map, east of the river Gelion. The upheaval that placed so much of the earth underwater basically placed most of the Silmarillion lands underwater. You can see a visual representation of this with the overlay map on this page, and I'm going to link to this map because it's a really cool map that shows how Beleriand and then Middle Earth and the Third Age, as we're familiar with it from Lord of the Rings, how they related to one another, right?
It
makes Beleriand seem much less foreign. I think this little maps like that would be such a huge boon to a Silmarillion and helping people get through the Silmarillion.
For sure.
I remember the first few times I tried to read it, I was just like, what is this place, Beleriand? This doesn't look anything like the map in Lord of the Rings. And you wanted it to, but it doesn't. That's your only point of reference, right? All right, great note. Thank you, Vogon Poet.
Yeah.
And then lastly is Oh Danny Boy on July 1st. Oh Danny Boy says, I do like this idea of a traveler coming to the Library of Gondor. Having a hobbit, like one of Sam's kids, traveling around to locations that have people telling them about the history of Middle-earth from previous ages. Or having a Valar take the guise of a simple elf, dwarf, hobbit and tell the stories over a campfire on the road to a traveler or a chronicler. There are so many different ways they could do it for a show or movie. I really just want to see the Battle of Fingolfin and Morgoth portrayed and done justice on the screen. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the frame narrative is something that if they ever do, you know, a revised or an expanded Silmarillion, right? You need the frame. You gotta come up with a great frame that's gonna draw people in. So, and make the path a little straighter for people.
I agree.
All right. Great feedback. Great.
That's fantastic.
Great correspondence this week, y'all. So good to hear from so many of you.
Absolutely.
And as always, you can contact us through TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, through the website, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, wherever you may roam. All right.
Yeah, wherever your road takes you.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be taking a week off, but I'm still coming at you with some content for next week on our regular release schedule. So stay tuned. And you'll have a little surprise waiting for you.
Oh, so,
yeah.
Surprises are fun.
Indeed. All right, that's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Lise U,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Johanna T,
Mike M,
Robert H,
Paul D,
Julia,
and Werty.
Hey.
As well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in July. Chris L.
David of Pints with Jack.
Joey S.
Eric S.
And Vite N.
Awesome. Thank you all.
Thank you all so much. Mm-hmm. And thanks to everybody for listening. We will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.